Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Benjamin Heckler. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in North Carolina. Ben, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you doing?
I am doing well, Grant. How are you doing?
Doing great. Just got done going to the annual AMIS meeting just a week and a half ago. So that was cool. Good to hear some good lectures and catch up with a lot of people. It was great to hear people listen to the podcast. So appreciative for those who are listening and for some of the input and new people I'm finding. So that'll be exciting and I'm coming up here.
That should be good.
Yeah. Well, good. Today, I'm excited to talk to you about benign aggressive lesions. This is a thrilling topic because it's not just benign, non-aggressive, but they're more aggressive. So tell us, what would make a lesion, quote unquote, aggressive?
Yeah, you know, I think, Grant, I like this topic because it's kind of a subset of lesions that we treat with some frequency, but they don't fall into like just one histologic category. I mean, I think you and I have even talked about like odontogenic tumors before, or you can talk about bony tumors, or, you know, you can talk about different types of soft tissue or nerve tumors. But, you know, there are certain pathologies within each one of those that are more aggressive or less aggressive. And so I think it's helpful to kind of talk about the ones that are more aggressive because many times they present similarly, even though they're not the same type of disease process. So, you know, when we talk about things that are more aggressive or something is acting or presenting aggressively, typically the things that we're talking about are patients that present with pain. They may even present with significant trismus that otherwise couldn't be explained by a TMJ problem. You know, they may report a history of very rapid change. All of a sudden this has been growing or this swelling has arisen in just like a month out of nowhere and now it's the size of a baseball. You also find a lot of these features not only on the exam and the history, but when you get just regular screening radiographs in the office. I mean, even if it's a panoramic radiograph, if not a CBCT, many times we learn that, you know, when you see osteolysis or when you see even dentinolysis, you know, destruction of tooth structure, particularly in an irregular pattern, we know that this is probably moving more quickly and acting more aggressively. And so those are the things right off the bat that typically when you look at a patient for the first time, you say, okay, this is acting a little bit more aggressively, even though we don't know what it is yet. You know, and that's in contradistinction to things that we know progress really slowly. And typically when you get a radiograph, you see a nice unilocular radiolucency, and maybe it's been there for a long time. It's maybe a centimeter bigger than it was on an X-ray 5-10 years ago. And those things clearly are acting very differently, even though both of these may be benign, meaning they're not at risk of metastasizing. It's not a cancer, but clearly they can't be treated the same way, even though they may be the same type. And, you know, I think another thing that should always prick your ears is if you treat something very conservatively, because up front maybe you didn't recognize or it wasn't acting aggressive, but then it recurs or it continues to recur, that would be an indication that, okay, in this case, there is something either about the pathology or about the patient's protoplasm or both that is making this act more aggressively, even if up front it didn't appear that way. So those are the things that I look for. And whenever I see those, my ears are kind of pricked again to say, okay, this may need to be treated a little bit differently than other lesions that don't present like this.
Okay. I like that. So pain, it's growing quickly. There's osteolysis, and if it recurs, all those things are kind of bumping this up to an aggressive type lesion.
Exactly. And I mean, this is not 100% one or the other, but those are the things that you should say, all right, either me or someone I'm going to refer this patient to, we probably need to take a close look at this and not just say, well, let's monitor it, right? Let's get another X-ray in 3 months and see. I bet this will go away. Or I bet it'll be stable. This is not the case where you do that.
Got it. Okay. And how about different type categories we could put these into? Are there various categories for benign aggressive lesions?
There's various different, unofficial categorizations. And if you look over the last decades, there are really great historic articles by many of the legends in our specialty and other individuals even outside of our specialty that have tried to categorize not only aggressive lesions, but within each lesion. Okay, how do we determine, for example, if a central giant cell granuloma is an aggressive type or a non-aggressive type? If, a TMJ lesion that's called pigmented villonodular synovitis, which can be aggressive, is it the aggressive type or the non-aggressive type? So people have done this over the decades, but what I like to do is kind of think, okay, what categories of pathology do have aggressive lesions? For example, typically we're not talking about odontogenic cysts, right? For the vast majority, we're not going to say a dentigerous cyst ever is aggressive. Yeah, it could be really big. It could have been there for a really long time. It could have caused tons of unnoticed expansion, but it's really not acting aggressively. Whereas odontogenic tumors, there are certainly aggressive lesions in that category. We think of ameloblastomas. I think of Pinborg tumors, calcifying epithelial odontogenic tumors. And then within the mesenchymal type, I think of myxomas. I think a lot of us have seen or treated myxomas, even if we just diagnosed it and sent it to someone else. Other categories that I think of, really an overarching one is giant cell lesions. If you categorize things with giant cell lesions, man, there are so many in there that can be considered aggressive or have aggressive types. And I think that's a good way to think of these too. We were just talking about central giant cell granuloma. I just mentioned pigmented villonodular synovitis. It's a little understood aggressive lesion of the TMJ that's really difficult to distinguish between a CGCG. And then there are other things as well. There's something called a juvenile ossifying fibroma, which is a type of benign fibrosseous lesion. So it's not periapical cementoosseous dysplasia. It's not florid cementoosseous dysplasia, but it is a benign fibrosseous lesion. It's also not fibrous dysplasia, but it occurs in young people. Grows very, very rapidly. And sure enough, on pathology, you tend to see in the aggressive type multinucleated giant cells. So, I think giant cell lesions as a category is a great one to look into too, if you're interested in looking at histopathology. And then there are some others too that, we're not really going to talk about today, but show up in the facial region. If you talk about sinonasal lesions, there are certainly sinonasal lesions that are treated by our ENT colleagues very frequently that are aggressive, but we don't treat those. And then another category too would be kind of lesions that show up in the parapharyngeal space. Again, not something that we really are going to talk about today, but we may see these in our practice. We get a CT or an MRI and we see something in the deep parapharyngeal space. Those can be very cryptic or aggressive lesions. And I think the last category, at least to mention now, that we do see in our practice is various vascular anomalies, be that vascular tumors like hemangiomas, or vascular malformations like AVMs or venous or capillary malformations. So those are the ones that I kind of think of that may have aggressive variants. That's not an exhaustive list. And of course, we're talking about benign today. But of all of those, I think one of the most interesting, at least to me, commonalities has been giant cell lesions. Giant cell
Interesting.
lesions, multinucleated giant cell lesions are just always very interesting to me, what falls into that category.
Okay. And are those like the more common ones you're seeing in this list?
Yes and no. Yes, because there are so many things that have giant cells, but as individual pathologies, you don't see each one of them very commonly. And many of them are quite rare, like the PVNS that I was talking about, the pigmented villonodular synovitis. Some of those are so rare. I mean, you see them a couple of times, maybe. I've seen that twice Same thing with things like juvenile ossifying fibroma. The ones, the aggressive lesions that I think we're typically seeing more frequently, just by the nature of not only their frequency in the population, but who we are, is the aggressive odontogenic tumors, right? Ameloblastomas, myxomas, maybe even a Pinborg tumor. Those are the really, really most common ones. If someone comes into our office, it's not cancer, but something looks really, really wrong. And we find out, yep, this is an aggressive odontogenic tumor.
Okay, got it. So maybe let's talk a little bit about just management. What are the principles of how to manage some of these lesions?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll talk, kind of broadly because you don't know. I think you and I have even talked about this before, when we talk about workup. You don't know what's coming in. You see someone that walks in with these symptoms, maybe pain, rapid growth. You get an X-ray, you see irregular expansion, osteolysis, but you don't know what the diagnosis is. That's why we're seeing the patient. And so it's a little bit backwards to say, well, here's my workup for ameloblastoma, right? Because we don't know it's ameloblastoma when they come in. Here's my workup for this. So, as an overarching workup for things that tend to be acting aggressively, if things come in with these findings, I think a history is really, really important, of course, in these, because some of these lesions will have a history of maybe very minimal slow growth that in retrospect the patient noticed over the course of 6 months. But then all of a sudden there was an event or a time that is memorable to them that, man, over the last month, this just really took off and something changed. That is helpful information for a time scale. Other things that are helpful again are the type of pain. And I think this is helpful because pain in and of itself can be an aggressive indicator, but what about nerve pain? Are they having dysesthesia? Are they having shooting shock-like pain? Is this something that's even invading a nerve sheath? I mean, that's something that's usually, we're usually talking about malignancy, right? And so if you hear that, that even makes you think, okay, maybe this isn't even benign aggressive, but malignant. But the specifics of the pain becomes very important. And then when the workup starts in the office, what do you get? Do you get a CT scan? Do you get a pano? Regardless of what you initially get, I think if you see features of something that's aggressive, again, osteolysis, resorption of tooth, expansion that can even be appreciated, on a panoramic, then you need to be getting three-dimensional imaging, or someone needs to be doing that. Again, you may elect to refer this patient, but I think not getting three-dimensional imaging in 2023 on something that's acting aggressively by someone as part of the workup is really probably not going to be sufficient at this time. And then we talk about the biopsy, because the biopsy itself is what's going to dictate if it's done correctly and if it gives you what you want. It's going to dictate what the actual diagnosis is and the treatment. And we've talked a little bit about the specifics of a biopsy before, particularly if you're worried about a vascular process, and we can review that again here if we get into it. But with these biopsies, I think the principle that's most important to remember, and almost any histopathologist will tell you this, is particularly when something is acting a little weird or if it's acting aggressively, you want to get a very hearty biopsy. You want to get a deep biopsy. You want to include lots of tissue because the superficial histopathologic features may not be either representative of what's really going on. There may be secondary inflammation or scarring or something that you're biopsying that primarily. Or if it is a diagnosis that ends up requiring significant features and a constellation of them to secure the diagnosis, you really want to get a good biopsy so that you can see all of those. And there are many of these lesions that histopathologically are not really 100% distinguishable from each other just on a biopsy anyway. So you want to get as much tissue as you can to give the pathologist as much information as he or she can get. And then that, in combination with your clinical findings, the progression and the radiographic findings should help with the diagnosis. One example of that, Grant, is benign fibrosis lesions, where the biopsy for those many times looks very similar between all different types of benign fibrosis lesions. I mean, fibrous dysplasia, periapical cemento-osseous dysplasia, ossifying fibromas, they have very similar histologic findings. It's only in combination with a good biopsy and then knowing the history and the imaging specifics, can you actually even render a diagnosis to determine what this is. And so I think those are the principles for working these up, but I would highlight that if it's acting aggressively, this really needs to be focused on. If it's, a unilocular radiolucency and you do a biopsy and it's just a simple cyst lining, well, then yeah, just grab a little bit of cyst lining and send it off and see what it is if that's what you're going to do. But if it's acting the way of an aggressive lesion, obviously just doing a tiny little superficial biopsy and not thinking twice probably isn't going to be sufficient to let you know what you need to do in these cases.
Okay. So it's kind of get the history of the growth if it's growing rapidly, the type of pain, if it's kind of more severe pain than you'd usually see. Imaging is, you definitely want to get the right imaging, and then taking a Hardy biopsy that has an intentional margin. And I assume with the Hardy biopsy, there's like an asterisk on like vascular lesions and making sure you know what it is type thing beforehand. Like we were talking about that one case in a prior biopsy situation where surgeon kind of got in some sticky situations by not realizing it was vascular before he biopsied.
Exactly. And I think that goes back to the principles for biopsy in general. And I think if I remember correctly, Grant, the way we had discussed that before is, we always learn right before you biopsy something, particularly if it's a lucency on a radiographic image, that you aspirate. We all are taught that. It's part of boards, it's all of that. But the other thing, the caveat to that, which I mean is not necessarily an answer I would give on a board exam, but is actually true in practice, is the only time that probably isn't required in a lesion that has some radiolucency is if you've gotten three-dimensional imaging with contrast already. Because if you've gotten a CTA or a CT with contrast, or if you've gotten an MRI with contrast, theoretically, the contrast, if this is a vascular lesion, should have really lit that up. And if it's still dark as night, well, it's really not that vascularized. And I still would aspirate it. Why wouldn't you? It takes 2 seconds. But in those scenarios, you could feel confident. Okay, there's probably not significant vasculature in here. And I think the other comment we made too, and we're really talking primarily about bony lesions today, is in bony lesions, it's real important because if you get into an AVM, you can't compress an intrabony lesion, right, and stop bleeding. Whereas if you got an AVM on the lip, I think was the example we gave previously when we were talking about this, I mean, you can compress the lip with your fingers and stop a bleeding artery. But in a bony lesion, you can't do that. And that's why it's so important in this scenario. And absolutely, that's why we listed vascular anomalies. They can look aggressive. They may not be ones that all of a sudden come out of nowhere, but they may result in pain. They may have a significantly erosive appearance on the scan. They may be present in young people, which also would maybe be an indicator that this is aggressive. So you absolutely need to consider that when you're considering your diagnostic differential.
That's good to know. And then as far as radiographic features that we should be looking at that would say, this is more than just your regular benign lesion. There's something more aggressive here. What would be on your list of things to be aware of?
Yes. And when I was in this goes back to dental school and something I remember learning in dental school out of our radiology textbook, which I know that sounds so nerdy to be reading a radiology textbook, Grant. I don't know if you ever read a radiology textbook in dental school, but we had Principles and Interpretation of Oral Radiology by Stuart White and Michael Farrow. And let me tell you, that was a fabulous book. It really was.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with what I'm talking about, but this
Yeah.
book, it just really walked through all the dental and pathology lesions at that time and how you should actually be interpreting your x-rays. And this is so important because we as OMFS providers and even before that, dentists, we interpret our own radiographs, right? I mean, we get three-dimensional imaging many times from imaging centers, but on a daily basis, we are interpreting our own radiographs. And really, the way that we have been taught and practiced is that we are the only one that's determining what's happening on those radiographs. It's not like we're sending it out every time to confirm that, yep, there's a lesion here. We're going to biopsy it, which is very different than probably everything else except for maybe orthopedics and ENT, where orthopedists typically take plain films, at least in their office. And otolaryngologists many times nowadays have CBCT scanners, particularly if they do sinus surgery. Not everyone does this. So I think it's really incumbent on us to know how to evaluate these imaging studies. And going back to this text, the text really had some principles in it that I use to this day that I think are just fabulous. And if you learn by this, you should have a nice guide. It's basically four things that you look at for every single lesion. The first is the location. Where is it located within the jawbones? Is it anteriorly? Is it posteriorly? Is it near the dentoalveolus? Is it near, the inferior border if we're talking about the mandible, or up in the sinuses if we're talking about the maxilla? The location of a lesion, wherever the epicenter is, will help initially, even with that alone, tell you what this lesion might be, right? We all know certain lesions are more likely in the mandible, in the posterior mandible, in the anterior mandible, crossing the midline in the mandible, or in the maxilla. So that alone can eliminate a lot of things that are very unlikely. I mean, possible, but very unlikely. The next one is the interior of the lesion. So is the lesion completely radiolucent? Is it completely radioopaque? Or is it mixed? Does it have aspects of both? And most of these aggressive lesions will, if you got a three-dimensional image, have both. Most of them will, because they have changes that are not only osteolytic, but there's many of these have hard tissue and soft tissue components internally. They're not cysts, right? And if you were to either look very closely on a panoramic or get three-dimensional imaging, there's going to be a mixed interior. And so that is something that we'll say, this may be more on the aggressive end as well, or at least in that category. The third thing is the periphery. What is the periphery of the lesion as it's expanding doing? We can see this a lot of times even on pano, right? Like we said, if it's eroding bone and it's atypical in its pattern, it's not a unilocular radiolucency, that's kind of acting a little aggressively. There are certain areas of the lesion that are progressing more quickly than other areas. And same thing with erosion of teeth. Now, again, not every lesion that erodes teeth is aggressive, but particularly if that erosion of teeth is in the same pattern of this atypical or irregular erosion of bone, that would be an indicator that this could be aggressive. And then the last thing, which is different than talking about the periphery, is the effect on surrounding structures. And that is it displacing things? Is it pushing teeth out of the way? Is it pushing bone and soft tissue out of the way, which would actually tend to be less aggressive? Or is it destroying those things as it goes towards them? Like we just talked about with the periphery of the lesion, not only is it destroying bone and teeth at the periphery of the lesion, but is it going through bone and destroying soft tissue around there as well? And that's where we talked, I think, at the very beginning of the podcast about they might not only have pain, but severe trismus. And we're talking about lesions there that are going beyond bone and into the masticator space or up towards the synovium of the TMJ, and they are invading and causing direct damage or inflammatory secondary damage to soft tissues. And now they have all these other symptoms. And so I have always evaluated this not only with panoramics, but 3D imaging. Where's the location? What does the interior look like? What's the periphery look like? And what's the effect on surrounding structures? And I have found that so helpful in just categorizing in my mind, okay, what's likely? What's unlikely? Is this aggressive? Is it less aggressive? And that even comes into play too if you were talking about the risk of malignancy.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good list to run through. Kind of where is it located? What are the kind of the peripheral or edges look like? What's going on inside of the lesion? And what's it doing to those surrounding structures? Can you talk to us a little bit about the ameloblastoma? I'm guessing that's one of the more common kind of benign aggressive lesions that you deal with. Can you kind of talk to us about how you treat those and manage them?
Yeah, I think the ameloblastoma is really the best one to talk about if you're going to start talking about a benign aggressive lesion in our specialty for multiple reasons. One, like you mentioned, it's one of the more common ones that we treat that's benign and aggressive, but also the history of ameloblastoma and how it's been treated is really a rich history to understand. And I mean, even to this day, there's still disagreement on how to treat these. And I'll tell you, I think if you look at cross-specialty history and literature, even though there's been more and more consensus within our specialty to treat these aggressively, there is not that consensus in other specialties. I will tell you that as a group, otolaryngologists, if they treat these, tend to treat these either less aggressively or more aggressively than we do, interestingly. And other individuals that do general type surgery occasionally that have head and neck training will get involved in these. But I do think there's a lot of inconsistencies with how these have been managed, partially because there's some inconsistent literature over the years. But yeah, what is this, and what are the principles of treating an ameloblastoma? Well, as most of us know, An ameloblastoma is one of the epithelial odontogenic tumors. It arises from ameloblasts, right, as we all know, so one of the progenitors of teeth. So it is an odontogenic tumor. And because of that, it's really only going to be in tooth-bearing regions of bone. And that's why it occurs where we find it in the mandible maxilla. You know, going back to the radiographic descriptors, what are we going to see when we say, oh, we think this might be an amelo? Vast majority, as we know, posterior mandible, right? Posterior molar region or ramus of the mandible. I've seen them everywhere, so has everyone else, but by far and away, it's going to be in the back. This is typically mixed. Sometimes on a panel, they look completely radiolucent, but they are mixed. The periphery can be variable, you know, depending upon when you catch this, but they tend to be, again, more on the aggressive side where, again, there's some irregularities in expansion. It may look like the border's here. No, is it there? If you catch them early, they can look less aggressive, but particularly when they have been in the posterior mandible and they've grown sizably before they've been noticed, this is what we find. Now, these typically don't cause a lot of pain, and they typically don't cause a lot of trismus, even if they get large, because, you know, for those of us who have treated these, most commonly they do still have a very thin shell of bone around them, just because of their growth rate. And so they may not present with pain and trismus, and they may actually just be very, very large and have a significant degree of osteolysis and may present in that way. Now, you know, we biopsy this, like we said, and you get your biopsy result back. How do you treat these? Well, this is where it's been, as many of us know, you know, discrepancy between individuals over the years. First of all, I think it's worth noting that there are different types of ameloblastoma. You know, we talk about the traditional or solid ameloblastoma, which is what we usually treat, and then the unicystic. Unicystic is a different animal, tends to occur in younger individuals, can be treated more conservatively, and that's because it also appears and acts less aggressively. But for the traditional amelo that is solid, that is having these aggressive features, I mean, I think it's pretty clear over the decades that these have to be treated with an intentional margin, meaning you have to cut this out with, you know, 1 to 1.5 centimeter margins. And don't forget that if these have extended into soft tissue, you need to include a soft tissue margin too, right? These are cases where we're not peeling off mucoperiosteum from an amelo that we see and then putting it back down. We have to take one layer beyond it. So if it hasn't gone through the cortex, we take the cortex. If it has gone and broken through the cortex, we take periosteum. We take whatever that layer is that is not breached, because even though this is not a malignancy, it is an aggressive lesion. And we know from multiple studies that this extends multiple millimeters beyond what we can see clinically or radiographically, which is why we take this margin. And so that is kind of the basis of the principles for ameloblastoma surgery. And you know, you can talk about how you repair them and everything, but remember, more aggressive things many times are larger and require a larger resection, like an amelo that requires an intentional margin. So they are ones that, even though they are benign, are much more likely to require things like free tissue transfer reconstruction, because so much tissue may actually be lost in treating them. So just because it's benign, you know, for those that don't have a lot of experience with this, don't think we shouldn't get a higher level of care involved, for significant reconstruction, almost as if this was a cancer case.
Hey, real quick attention to all residents and fellows who graduated within the last 6 months. KLS Martin is offering one-time sale pricing for newly graduated oral and maxillofacial surgeons. The sale includes discounts on a Bioneer ChiroPro with 5 handpieces, the Spectra G6 headlight, which is awesome, oral surgery instrumentation, and in-office bone graft kit components. This is an incredible deal, so don't forget to ask your KLS reps about this. So please enjoy.
Got it. Yeah, and are you usually seeing these associated with, I guess the question I was thinking is, it's usually more younger people, and then also, can you comment on if it's usually associated with an impacted tooth?
Yeah, those are good topics. So the unicystic ameloblastoma is very, very commonly with younger individuals, very common. The solid really occurs in all ages, but I think kind of if you look, and every study will give you different age ranges, but the majority of them are kind of between 20 and 50. They're kind of young to maybe up to middle-aged adult, but it's the unicystic one that is much more commonly. Oh, okay, here's a 15-year-old. Yep, that's unicystic. That's who you're seeing these in. And, I think you asked me one other question there, Grant. Sorry, I forgot the second question, in addition to who you're seeing these in.
Well, yeah, do these usually arise from
Oh, with a tooth.
the tooth?
Yes, they certainly can, but they do not have to. And if you look at it again, there are various studies that have looked at all of the literature published and looked at the percentage of time that they're associated with teeth and the percentage of time that they're not. You know, and for ameloblastoma, they certainly can be, but it's much less common, you know, than something like we're used to, like dentigerous cysts and things like that, where we see a tooth, we see a lesion that's a certain association with the tooth. We say, yep, that's 99% of the time a dentigerous cyst. With an ameloblastoma or with imaging that you say, oh, this is kind of aggressive. If there's a tooth in there or if there's not a tooth in there, I am still including ameloblastoma extraordinarily high on the list.
Got it. If they don't arise from a tooth, it just is like an enamel rest that was kind of stuck during development. Is that the
Yeah,
thought?
exactly. And you know, remember that when we talk about the dental lamina, the tissue that forms teeth, it progresses from midline posteriorly, which is why in general, you know, the teeth erupt anteriorly and then more posteriorly. And the last teeth to erupt are our second molars and then our third molars, right? And some people don't develop third molars because that dental lamina fades out back there and they actually don't develop it. Some people develop supernumerary teeth, right? Fourth molars. I know my father was one that had a fourth molar, and I know multiple people that have developed multiple fourth molars. And it's because that dental lamina tissue can still proliferate. So as it goes posteriorly and it fizzles out, that is where we tend to see more of the additional tissue, the rests like you're talking about, that then over time gets stimulated for one reason or another and can develop odontogenic tumors, even though there's not like a fully formed tooth in there.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's fantastic to kind of review the ameloblastoma. Maybe could you talk a little bit about vascular anomalies and how to determine if they are more aggressive, like an AVM versus something that's less concerning?
Absolutely. And I think vascular anomalies is a great thing to talk about because it's something that we tend to not talk about or kind of forget because we say, well, it's a vascular thing. It's not really, you know, something in our wheelhouse, but we see them and you can see them in the oral cavity and head and neck quite frequently. I would encourage people, if you're not familiar with it, to look up the ISSBA. The ISSBA has great information. It's the International Society for the Study of Vascular Anomalies. They have great information that really helped clarify for me when I was first learning about these, how you should categorize these. Because I think, and I might have said this before on one of our podcasts, Grant, I think we use the wrong terms all of the time for vascular anomalies. And, you know, vascular anomalies come in two flavors, vascular tumors that are actually tumors, they're actually growths, or vascular malformations, which are, you know, developmental abnormalities that occur. And then that's what we're talking about with an AVM or a venous malformation or a capillary malformation. So vascular tumors are actually separate than vascular malformations. So vascular tumors are things like hemangiomas, things like that, that typically don't cause significant problems, whereas malformations may or may not. I think one of the biggest things to know when we're talking about vascular anomalies is some of the radiographic features. And you know, what is nice to know, first and foremost, is if you are getting plain imaging in your office of a lesion and let's say it's pigmented and it's in soft tissue even, or it's coming out of bone, you think this could be vascular of some type. If you within that area, either on CT scan, panoramic, whatever, if you see little calcifications in there, those would typically be phleboliths. Those would be venous calcifications. And that is not going to occur in an AVM. You know, AVMs also, we talk about palpating and listening, right, for a thrill and bruit. And that's not common that you're actually going to anticipate or appreciate that on physical examination. But you certainly should be palpating for a second or two to see, does this lesion have a pulse? You know, that would be an indication as well. As we mentioned, most of the ones we're talking about and seeing are intrabony. So you're not necessarily going to be able to do that anyway. But I do think one of the most helpful things is that first image. Does that image have phlebolysts, little calcifications in it? That is pathognomonic for a venous malformation, not an AVM. Again, think about when this is occurring. You know, we were talking about it earlier in the history. Has this been there for a long time? And then all of a sudden there was growth out of nowhere. You know, over the last month, it's really changed. You know, a lesion that's increased in pain, size, swelling, whatever, during illness or something like that is many times a congenital cyst or could be a vascular malformation as well. So that's another thing to keep in mind in that scenario. I think the biggest thing in the end to rule out one versus the other are the special studies, right? The CTA or the MRA, that's really going to tell you, okay, not only is this vascular, but what phase of the contrast is seen in this lesion to identify that. And the reason it is so helpful is because if you have a high concern for an AVM, you don't want to do anything surgically with it. You want to identify it, diagnose it with a CTA or MRA, and then consider embolization before you do anything surgically whatsoever if you're going to be the one treating it.
Yeah, that's helpful to know those various type of radiographic findings and distinguishing them.
And I will say, I'll just highlight again the ISSVA. They have some great tables on that website. If anyone's truly interested in learning a little bit more about vascular anomalies, the ISSVA is great for helping to kind of get a handle on what we're actually talking about that falls into that category and what doesn't.
Okay. Sounds good. Real quick, and how are you treating the venous malformation differently from the AVM?
Well, you know, the venous malformations, and it depends. The venous malformations, luckily, the ones that I have actually seen are quite small. And if they are quite small venous malformations, I mean, they can be removed just like we would remove anything else. And for the most part, it doesn't cause an issue. I mean, obviously, if you're concerned for some type of a vascular anomaly, you're probably getting imaging beforehand. But if it truly is a venous malformation, usually it's not a problem. In fact, most of these are even called hemangiomas on a histology report, where many times they actually were venous malformations. And this is why I say sometimes the terminology gets a little mixed up. But yes, you're typically treating those that way. You know, the ones that can get tricky are the capillary malformations or the lymphocapillary malformations that are just diffuse all over the place. And those you're typically just not resecting, like when they're on the tongue or floor of mouth, you're not just resecting a tongue or floor of mouth. You know, there are other ways with different sclerosants and other therapies to treat those. But usually the small to medium-sized venous malformations, in my experience with them, the ones I have seen and been referred, are pretty small and really inconsequential as far as treating them much differently.
Got it. All right. And then maybe you could talk just a little bit about some of the aggressive TMJ lesions.
Yeah. You know, I think, and this is another category that, you know, you could have a whole discussion on, like TMJ lesions or condyle lesions. I know when I was learning about different pathologies, I, you know, basically made a group of things that I called condylar lesions. You know, what things are more likely to occur here, not necessarily that are TMJ or TMD issues, but pathology that just happens to go there. You know, and there are some of them that are typically less aggressive, excuse me, but still benign. The most common ones are things like osteochondroma, which are benign growths of bone and cartilage. We all talk about synovial chondromatosis, which is it a tumor? Is it a metaplastic process? What is it? There's been disagreement. But CGCGs also occur up there, as well as aneurysmal bone cysts. But the main one that tends to act aggressively, although really out of control, synovial chondromatosis can present with pain and trismus and everything when it really expands and causes a proliferation of cartilaginous and osseous nodules in the synovium. The main one that just acts very differently and is benign and aggressive, although there is report that it can turn into a malignant lesion, is pigmented villonodular synovitis. And this is something that I did not know about for quite some time. It is quite rare. It can occur in joints that have a synovium. And so, of course, the TMJ is one of those joints. And this is a process that, again, looks like it's really severe chronic inflammation, but also is probably a distinct neoplastic process as well. And I've only seen, as I mentioned before, a couple of these. And when you get three-dimensional imaging with contrast on these, you can have various findings that, regardless of what you get, there is significant inflammatory change, usually significant expansion that kind of mimics the location of the synovium. There's actually a couple of different types of this. One is more focal, and the type that really is the aggressive type is diffuse, meaning the entire synovium typically does this. Well, the problem if the entire synovium has a neoplastic or an inflammatory process in the TMJ is it's going to immediately start eroding into the middle cranial fossa, right? I mean, we're worried about that anyway when we're just doing routine TMJ surgery and there's a really thin middle cranial fossa because of a little bit of inflammation. And these can very quickly result in communication with the dura. And so these individuals, as we mentioned before, may show up not only with pain, but very significant trismus. They may have overlying erythema and tenderness of the TMJ. And very commonly, these ones that are treated surgically, you know, will need a combined approach. Like I said, as they've gone into the middle cranial fossa, it's very common that you would need to reach out to your neurosurgical colleagues. The other thing that's interesting about this is that the recurrence rates for this are not insignificant. And I don't know how high they actually are, but they are not insignificant, probably because of the difficulty with trying to remove everything based on the location of this. And so this is a lesion that has been discussed with regard to postoperative radiation, even though it's not a malignancy. You know, I didn't get talking into this with regard to ameloblastoma, but, you know, that has in the past been suggested as a treatment for recurrent ameloblastoma when surgery is either insufficient or not possible. And it has been suggested, too, in PVNS. And yeah, radiation is not meant for benign things. We use it for malignancy. But the idea is if things are acting more aggressively and are proliferating more quickly, you know, similar to the features of malignancy, there may be a role for consideration of some degree of radiotherapy in those type of cases that are refractory to surgical management.
That's good to hear about. I have not heard that. So it's interesting.
Yeah. It's very interesting. And I mean, again, these are not processes that are going to walk into your office, you know, this month after you hear it on a podcast and say, oh, what are you looking for? Oh, there it was. I just never saw it. No, I mean, you're going to see it very infrequently if you see it. And even if you see it, you probably won't recognize it until after the fact. But they are interesting processes to be aware of. And even just considering that there may be a benign aggressive process that involves the total synovium. So if you were to get a special scan and see that, and go, whoa, something really weird is going on up there. Hey, then you have something like this that you say, you know what, it could be one of those really weird things. Let me send it to so-and-so and see if he or she could take a look. Not that you're going to do anything different, but it gives you a little bit more insight into what may be going on and at least counseling the patient. And I think we've even talked about this on an unrelated podcast. I mean, at the very least, it's helpful to counsel the patient. Be like, listen, here's kind of the categories of things that could be going on. I don't know what's going on. It could be this type of thing. It could be this type of thing. And here's what I see. And let's have someone else evaluate it. It just helps you communicate with the patient.
Yes, totally. Okay. And then what are some of the benign fibrosis type lesions we may see in our office?
Yeah. So benign fibrosis lesions really come in three categories. The most well-known one probably is fibrous dysplasia, which is really usually not aggressive, even though it can grow very large over a period of time. And that is the congenital genetic malformation that occurs in the GNAS gene. And that causes fibrous dysplasia, as we're very common, as we all know, in either facial bones or it could be craniofacial or, you know, multiple bones can be involved in fibrous dysplasia. There is also the reactive type, and that's what we talk about with cementoosseous dysplasia, and that's the most common type we talk about, right? Periapical cementoosseous dysplasia in the anterior mandible around the roots of the mandibular incisors, and just because you see a lesion that's a targetoid lesion or a radiolucency or a completely opacified lesion, if the tooth tests vital and is percussion negative, we don't do root canals on them, just willy-nilly because of periapical cementoosseous dysplasia. Although we all still see that happen, fortunately. And then the neoplastic benign fibrosis lesion, the one that can be more aggressive, is ossifying fibroma, which the name has gone back and forth between ossifying fibroma and cemento-ossifying fibroma. But the aggressive subtype is what I had mentioned before, the juvenile ossifying fibroma. And the juvenile ossifying fibroma, again, is in and of itself not overly that common, but it is helpful to know because when it occurs, it can be quite aggressive. So by definition, this is juvenile ossifying fibroma. So it tends to occur. And I think what the WHO, the World Health Organization, what their cutoff was for looking at the typical age of onset was before 15 years of age, I think. That may have been updated, but it certainly is more common in young individuals. If you get a biopsy, it looks like a benign fibrosis lesion, right? So that's why I said sometimes it's hard to distinguish things just by the biopsy alone. And that's why the history, the physical examination, and the radiographic findings are so important. And there are a couple different types of juvenile ossifying fibroma. And interestingly enough, right, these lesions contain multinucleated giant cells when they are more aggressive like this, just like we were talking about. So again, there comes the multinucleated giant cell again. And these tend to expand very rapidly and can be quite destructive and have a very high rate of recurrence. And part of it is because they tend to occur in the maxillary sinus, many of these. And so they expand very largely up the maxilla and the maxillary sinus towards the floor of the orbit. They can even cause, you know, displacement of the orbit into the sinus, into the pterygopalatine region or retromaxillary region. And it's just very difficult at many times to get everything very cleanly and be very happy with a clean resection. And so these are cases where you need to be aware of them because technically it's a benign fibrosis lesion, but it's very aggressive. It's going to be in younger patients. There's going to be obvious expansion. But, you know, if you were to just look at a snapshot in time and look at a CT screenshot that someone sent you, if you didn't have the history, if you didn't have the story from the patient, and if you maybe didn't look at some serial imaging, at one point in time, you could say, oh, that looks like just part of a fibrous dysplasia or something. Like, that's probably been there forever. Don't worry about it. Well, no, in these scenarios, it's not. It's a totally different type of benign fibrosis lesion that requires, you know, very wide resection, like we're talking about with an ameloblastoma, for example.
Yeah, that's a good one to kind of keep on your radar and know about. How about with these tumors? I mean, you've mentioned a couple things we can do for things that are recurring, but what do you do for these aggressive ones that you've resected and they just keep coming back, you know, sometimes multiple recurrences?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that, you know, can be done now. And then even speaking into what I think will become more commonplace in the future for these lesions in general, and particularly the ones that are difficult to treat, you know, what you can do now is when you perform your upfront surgical intervention, I think it's always helpful to consider where recurrence would be likely to occur and or how you would treat it if it did occur. Because, you know, all of these can occur, all these benign aggressive lesions can occur. And if you're in a scenario where you're thinking this is going to be very, very difficult to treat if it recurs, just based upon the location and based upon what I found during this surgery, this is going to be very, very difficult if this comes back. And I think you need to have this discussion early on. Like you mentioned, there are adjuncts, including radiotherapy for a few of these. That is not at all commonplace. But I think the takeaway is if you are treating a benign aggressive lesion, even though it's not a malignancy, if it is really aggressive or if it has recurred multiple times or if something else is acting up, do not hesitate if you have access to it to bring this to your multidisciplinary tumor board. I mean, we absolutely discuss benign cases on tumor board. Remember, it's not a cancer board, it's a tumor board. And almost every institution, even though this is 99% cancer cases, when there are very difficult, aggressive, benign lesions, that's why you want to talk to these individuals. And nowadays in medical oncology, there are all these advancements for medical oncology interventions that actually have applications to benign lesions too. We're learning more and more about genetic defects in things like OKCs, ameloblastomas, all of the other common ones, myxomas, that there may be medical interventions for. And as I mentioned, same thing with radiation. Sometimes radiation has a limited role in these. So I would say if you're having difficulty with this, the overarching principle is get others involved. And if you have access to it or someone you know has access to it that you can refer them to, a tumor board is a great location to actually discuss these benign cases. Other things we talk about, obviously we didn't talk about OKC today because it's a odontogenic cyst that tends not to be aggressive. But speaking of recurrence, it's one of those things that can act a little bit that way otherwise because it can recur so frequently. And, you know, this is where also some of the medical advancements have come into play nowadays with 5-FU that many of us use again because of the underlying mechanisms of mutations within that lesion and the way 5-FU works. And again, looking into the future, I kind of highlighted it there by saying the medical oncology team many times has insights. There is so much that's changing in the management of many of these more common pathologies. And I really do think we will look back in many decades from now and think how barbaric it was that we were doing these huge surgeries on these patients. I really think all of this will be managed much more medically. I think doing things like huge resections and free fibulas when the future be looked at as barbaric, even though it's the standard of care right now for these very large resections. I think the same thing is true for a lot of surgery. I mean, let's get off topic for a second, even like bariatric surgery. Some of the drugs that are coming out now, right, for weight loss and for curbing appetite, I mean, they are going to be so honed in that people will look back and say, oh my gosh, you opened them up and you cut out and rerouted everything in their stomach and intestines to make this work. That was crazy. And it's all because of the advancements on the medical side, not the surgical side. So I would tell people to stay in tune with what's happening with medications, because in the research arena, not necessarily in the clinical arena yet, there is a lot of research going into promising therapies to treat things like OKCs, ameloblastomas, other benign aggressive tumors.
Yeah, that stuff is fascinating. Yeah, I hope we get there soon. Some of these patients I've seen that have gone through these big surgeries, it's just can be so hard afterward and stuff like that. So pretty good information, but I really appreciate you running through all of these benign aggressive lesions, kind of giving us some of the principles of treating them and diagnosing them. I think this is a good review. Any other comments you had about this topic?
No, I think, Grant, those are the main ones. I mean, you know, in the end, like we talked about at the beginning, you can categorize these things however you want. And so I think it's helpful just in your mind to look at different categories of processes. Okay, you know, how could these be similar? Again, in the discussion today, a lot of them can be multinucleated giant cell lesions. You can also look at the traditional categories of odontogenic tumors. You can also say, what about, again, location? Like I said, condylar lesions. What lesions are most common in the TMJ and condyle? And the more that you kind of weave this web of how do I think about these things, the easier it will be to understand them. And it's a lot of work to try to do that, but it really does pay off, because then you see how things interrelate or how they're connected. And benign aggressive lesions is one of those that I think really helps to bring different types of the disease processes together and say, no, there is something similar that we need to be aware of when we diagnose these and treat them.
Okay. Terrific. Well, thank you so much for discussing this. I assume you're good with people reaching out to you. I can put your email in the show notes if you're okay with that.
Absolutely, Grant.
I had many people at the Amos meeting tell me how much they love the podcast episodes I do with you. And so I think there's a lot of people who appreciate this information.
Yeah,
one resident came up to me and said, that information that, you know, you talk about on the podcast, especially with Dr. Heckler, that's really the only form of studying or learning I do during residency. And that, I was like, oh, okay. That was a little disturbing, but
Now am I like liable now if someone fails boards or doesn't get out of their residency program? You. I don't know who that was, but that needs to change. Whoever that was, please, please do not tell people I'm the reason that you either did something right or wrong. My gosh, Grant, I'm in trouble.
That's the answer. Well, I mean, Dr. Heckler told me. Okay. So no, I think always supplement what we're talking about here with further study, you know, and textbooks and discussions with your program directors and whoever. But no, I do think this is a good foundation, especially for those who are just like doing so much and running from place to place. It's nice to have this option of listening to it in the car. And I know it's tough to read a textbook when you get home at like 9 p.m. after you've been hustling all day.
Absolutely.
All right, my man. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's reconnect soon.
Sounds good, Grant. Have a good one.
You too. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.